Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today. The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Polly says a taco? Let's start that debate.
Welcome to Recotopia, a happy home for recommended movies, TV shows, music, video games, foodstuffs, and more from two people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. And now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson and Aaron Dicer.
I try to slow my heart down and breathe the fire out of my lungs. My muscles make me 1,000 promises of pain to come.
Let me do it, Marv. She was my sister. Let me finish him.
You wasn't supposed to come down here, Wendy.
Oh, but I want to.
I'm sorry, kid, but I haven't even started with this creep.
Hello, everybody. It is episode 120 of Recotopia. My name is Chris Atkins, and I am joined by Aaron Dicer.
Heidely ho, Sin City Arenos.
Indeed. Once again, I'd like to welcome Chet, who have come out here and watch us talk about movies here on a Tuesday. Today is Sin City, starting a series of movies that I have been recommended that I do not like, and is perhaps the second or third viewing. Actually, in this case, this would have been my third or fourth viewing right off the bat. I've watched this many times, by the way, over the weekend, watching commentaries and the like. But is the idea of, do I just need to see this with different eyes or whatever? That was that was the point. And do I end up liking it this time? So stay tuned to find out. I'm going to start us off with our small recommends.
It's no big deal.
Itty bitty living space.
It's so small and light.
It's small. It's tiny. It's petite. It's wee.
I have not seen, some of the, Disney classics back in the day. I've seen the Tim Burton Alice in Wonderland. I had not seen the original Disney animated Alice in Wonderland, which I watched on Disney Plus over the past week. And I love old animation, man. There's something about it. I can't quite put my finger on it. I don't know what the technical terms are for it. There's a motion to it that's completely different than what it became later on, when, you know, when Little Mermaid and everything sort of kickstarted them back up and everything. It's kind of a slower, methodical animation. And they do things with the characters in it that are very interesting that I don't feel like I see in modern day movies at all. And in this case too, they actually got a voice actor who was the age of the character in the book to do this. They get a 13-year-old to do the voice of Alice, and she's wonderful on this. But I think the thing about this movie that excites me so much is that this was one of the craziest movies that you could watch back in 19. I mean, it feels like one of the craziest movies you could watch. Maybe I have 1951 all wrong. Maybe it was this. Maybe there was a room for all this looniness going on, but you know, the original Lewis Carroll stuff is in itself very loony. And this is an adaptation of not only Alice in Wonderland, but Through the Looking Glass as well. They have a lot of different vignettes basically all the way through this. But man, the animation in this original is so just, it's just a wonder to behold. And we're so used to the computer animation these days, and Disney tried to get hand-drawn back again. I don't know. Have they, I haven't really been keeping up. Have they been doing any hand-drawn in a while? Like they had that string where they did some, but now I don't know if they do anymore.
Interestingly enough, Pixar has done some hand-drawn shorts that are interesting. But even the hand-drawn stuff these days has computer generated elements to it. Mm-hmm. So, the last, I'm sure I would need a day to like dig in and study, but the last great hand-drawn animation film I remember is Prince of Egypt, and that was DreamWorks. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of the Disney hand-drawn stuff, like Princess and the Frog was, I think, their last like real attempt at it. And that mm-hmm. movie was good. That it's not like that movie was bad, but, but it wasn't like a classic, like, you know, the others were. So, yeah.
And all the John Lasseter stuff may have put the kibosh on a lot of this, and who knows the cost of doing it or whatever. I think there's room for it. That's what killed me back in the day when Toy Story like came in, and started, you know, everybody's like, ooh, look at this computer animation stuff. They started giving all the best stuff to the computer animation, and then the hand-drawn, all those were just terrible movies. Mm-hmm. And they're like, well, nobody wants to see hand-drawn anymore. And it's like, well, yeah. I wonder why. But anyway, I really, really dug this. I highly recommend it. So,
yeah, I haven't seen it in a while, but it to me is one of like the classic Disney's. This and Fantasia are the two that I tell people, like, if you think you understand what Disney movies are, watch these movies, because they were experimental at times. You know, Disney was very insistent on really pushing the limits of imagination and, you know, what you could do in this stuff. And the company was aware that some of the best, you know, skills of animation are creating things that you couldn't do in live action, right? Like you can draw it if you can't shoot it. And so they would do a lot of fun stuff like that. Even Dumbo. Dumbo's got some really weird stuff in it, man.
it really does.
So, like, yeah, animation has always been an avenue for experimentation. And Alice in Wonderland's a great example of that. It's a really fun movie. My first recommend is Inside Out 2. This shouldn't be a surprise for people that know my love of Pixar and my love of the original. The original Inside Out is in my top five movies of all time. I think what Pete Docter did in envisioning that world is genius. This is a brand new director whose name slips my mind. He has taken on this world that Pete Docter has built and I think added some really interesting twists to it. I was saying to someone after we watched this movie that the most impressive things about these movies to me are the language it gives its audience to discuss their own worlds. And you come out of a movie like this, and you will see a group of, you know, adolescent, pre-adolescent girls chatting, and you'll hear like bits and pieces of, oh, that's so like me when, you know, anxiety was doing this thing. Like, I feel that. Like, I know how, like, and it gives a language to be able, all these things that are internal to us, these movies have given us a way to communicate with each other about what's going on in our head. I've heard parents talk about their children saying, you know, anger is at the console today, you know, kind of thing. Like, And I think that's the miracle of these movies and one of the reasons I'm so drawn to them and I love them so much. They're also a ton of fun. And Inside Out 2 is also really, really fun. Lots of funny moments, lots of little clever sight gags. Like you may remember, like in the original Inside Out, when the box of opinions and the box of facts get mixed up and they're like, oh, my facts got mixed up with my opinions. And they're like, yeah, it seems to happen a lot these days. There's a lot of stuff like that in here. There's a really fun use of imagination land that I didn't see coming that I thought was really, really cool. Overall, Maya Hawke is incredible as Anxiety. Anxiety comes on to the scene here and does some really interesting work with understanding that the character of Anxiety isn't a villain. The character of Anxiety is this thing in us that wants what's best, but he's trying so hard to avoid the bad things, think about possible, you know, futures, think about where it could go wrong, that if it's not balanced in a healthy way, it can be destructive. The movie makes a great shift from the emotional inner life to the sense of self. This does some things with understanding, like a self-awareness, that I thought were really fascinating and interesting. I love this movie. It'll take a few more viewings for me to know if how close it gets to the original. I don't think it's as good as the original. But for now, this is just a great, great movie. I had a really good time with. So, yeah,
I want to see this, even though I wasn't super high on the first one. I liked it okay, but I wasn't over the moon about it like a lot, but I was excited about this one for some reason. I don't know. I'm going to have to give this one a check it out for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So, my next one was a list of shame movie I had not seen, an old Western from John Ford called Stagecoach, which I think just about every big director has come out to say this is something that influenced them at some point. Spielberg especially. I believe Spielberg, I can't remember what, it might have been his movie Duel, or it was Jaws. I can't remember which one. I saw in the trivia that said that he watched this movie like basically on loop during, he watched it like 14 days in a row or something, trying to, you know, to study things from it and things like that. But this is a very simple and very short story, and I really enjoyed the fact that it was so brisk, but it's very simple. You have a stagecoach that is going to carry a whole variety of people with different opinions and different personalities together. There are two women and there are a bunch of men, and there are a bunch of men who have ideas what it's to be a gentleman and what is it, what is the code of the West and all this other stuff. It's this stagecoach that has to go through Apache country to get to this one town, and everybody's got their goal in mind to get to this town. One woman's trying to find her husband, and she's got a secret that nobody knows about, but she's trying to find her husband. Another's trying to start a new life. Another person's trying to get to Kansas. There's all sorts of different things going on in here. John Wayne is probably introduced in this movie like one of the most legendary introductions into a movie I've ever seen, with this huge like zoom up to his character and a gun in his hand and everything. John Wayne is looking for revenge on the people who wrongfully accused him and went, he had to go to jail over it. So the whole movie is really, it's the tensions going on in the stagecoach. The Apache stuff is always in the background for the most part. Obviously that's going to be a thing later on, but it's always something that they're worried about, and they keep going to places that are burned down and like, oh, so it's right around the corner and everything. And there's, should we even be on a stagecoach? Should we even do this is a big question, but I really enjoyed this. This is a, like something that, you know, they did really good work with characters back in this, back in the day here. Like, you don't see this very much, I don't think, in movies from this time. It just seemed like, wow, that's a breath of fresh air in an old classic movie, that there's depth a lot to a lot of these characters and everything. But the action that does end up showing up on screen is very well made. Of course, this is one of those all-time legendary stunt person movies where people are doing stuff that they probably shouldn't be doing, but they do it for the love of the art. And really, really, really highly enjoyed this.
I watched this a while back, and I was trying to catch up on some of the old Westerns. And this is many times stated as inventing, you know, the Western craze that Hollywood went through, you know, for several decades there. I didn't like it as much as you. I found it difficult to connect to some of these characters. However, that final action scene blew my mind. I was just like, whoa. How many people died while they were filming this? Like, this is insane, the actual things that, right. that that people are doing on that. I think what I learned during my trip through a lot of these old Westerns is that I don't connect to the Western ideal as much as some people do. So, like, right. you know, there's a machismo to it that just misses me. And the John Wayne characters always miss me for some reason. But I was definitely impressed with the craft, and especially that final chase scene is just incredible. Yeah. So
good.
My second small recommend is another movie I watched recently. It is called Breaking Away. It's from 1979. Dennis Quaid and some others. I think Daniel Stern in there is one of the main roles as well. Jackie Earle Haley is one of the four main characters too. It's about four friends in Bloomington, Indiana. Now, I will admit part of my interest in this is that this is shot and set in Bloomington, where my mom was born and raised. So I have been to Bloomington many, many times to visit my grandparents, and I am familiar with the area. And I will say one of the things that this is a Peter Yates film. One of the things Peter Yates gets so right in this movie is Bloomington. It's clear it was shot there, that there's an understanding of the weather there, the people there, how Indiana University impacts the town, because it's a university town. It's IU is located there in Bloomington. And it deals a little bit with the, you know, the thing that college towns have with the locals, the townies. You'll hear them called a lot. They call them cutters in this because there's stone quarries there in Bloomington where a lot of people work. The actual term they use in Bloomington is stoners or stonies, but they were afraid people would associate that with just being druggies. And so they changed it to cutters in the movies, which I think is actually a pretty decent choice, because I think they're right. People would have been like, oh, it's a stoner thing or whatever. There's some really cool stuff at a local quarry where like water has pooled in this like cool rectangular pool. That's some really interestingly shot stuff. This comes down to a sports movie at the end. These four guys end up forming a bicycle team based on the love of French cycling, or I should say Italian cycling, that the main character has. In fact, he spends a lot of the first half of this movie speaking Italian, pretending to be Italian, like he's just fallen in love with the Italian racers. And then he races against them, and they are not so nice. And he ends that love of the Italians very, very fast. But the final race is interesting, fun, and the performances are great. I believe this was nominated for several Oscars, including Best Picture. That year, and if it weren't for Kramer versus Kramer, might have won a few more. So I highly recommend Breaking Away. I think it's a really good film.
Yeah, this is something that I've never seen. This is one of these movies that I've heard about for years and years and years, and I've never gotten around to seeing it. So I will have to give it a look one day. All right, on to the big recommend.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah. That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
Which, again, I will say, is a movie that... It is a series that I'm starting about movies that have been recommended to me that I have never liked. And, you know, this was an 8.0 on the IMDb. Of course, it's a big movie for this podcast, because during a questioning... question of some sort, I was very much down on it, and I said, you guys are entitled to your wrong opinions about it. so It is Sin City. It is from the year 2005, which is one of the worst movie years ever, in my opinion. And I may have just had enough when I had finally gotten around to this one. Again, I wrote a ton on this, and we'll see how it goes. I hope I don't cut out too much, but we're going to start us off here. Welcome to Sin City. The actual name is Basin City, but like a couple of sneakers trying to figure out which San Francisco bridge Robert Redford went over while inside a car trunk, they've scratched the bay. Our movie begins with the customer, played by Marley Shelton, a woman in red on a balcony while Josh Hartnett waxes poetic narration. He provides her with a cigarette and seduces her before shooting her. Afterwards, he says that he'll cash her check tomorrow morning, implying that the customer ordered her own hit. After the title card and opening credits filled with mostly 80s and 90s stars, we are introduced to a cop named Hartigan, played by Bruce Willis, who informs us he's got 1 hour left on his last day of the job, and he has angina. Not to be confused with, you know, a city in Saskatchewan. He's looking for a missing 11-year-old girl named Nancy. He arrives at a place where his partner Bob, played by Michael Madsen, tells him he needs to slow his roll. But Hartigan says this is the fourth girl who's been kidnapped, and he knows that a senator's kid by the name of Rourke is responsible. Bob tells him he's too old for this and he needs to get back to his wife. So, of course, Hartigan one punches him unconscious, the first of nearly 17 million such punches in the movie, while he proceeds with the case. Hartigan runs into two overwordy henchmen, one played by Ron Swanson, and takes them out. We are introduced to the main bad guy of this story, Rourke Jr., played by Nick Stahl. When Hartigan breaks down an easily collapsible door and gets shot, Rourke runs and carries Nancy outside, but runs into a dead end on a pier. Rourke reminds Hartigan he's untouchable, but he shoots Rourke in the ear. Hartigan then shoots off his right hand and shoots off his middle leg. Then surprise Bob shoots Hartigan full of more holes, apparently with the idea that those wounds won't kill him. After reaching for his second gun, Bob shoots him some more. I guess blood loss doesn't account for anything. Hartigan goes unconscious, knowing it. Seriously, everybody goes fucking unconscious in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Goes unconscious, knowing his death saved the little girl. And just when you think you've got a handle on this story, it switches to a whole new story and character. Marv, played by Mickey Rourke. Marv is about to get down and dirty on a heart-shaped bed with someone he doesn't know is a prostitute named Goldie, played by Jamie King. The sex is so good that once they go to sleep, they don't hear Psycho Frodo walk in and kill Goldie. When he wakes up, Marv does the standard "Are the naked perfect breasts moving?" technique to see that Goldie isn't breathing. Soon after that, the cops show up. Marv vows revenge on her behalf, takes care of some of the first responders, and jumps down a stairway and out the building before smashing into a police car windshield. It appears the very laws of physics can't hurt this guy. After taking over the police car, driving it into the ocean, and traveling through a handy sewer pipe, he visits his parole officer, Lucille, played by Carla Gugino, who prefers to confront intruders in the nude. Mark provides the much-needed exposition that Lucille is gay. After Marv tells Lucille he's ready to go to war, he does what is natural and runs on a rooftop before jumping down back into an alleyway. It takes him to a bar called Katie's, where a grown-up Nancy, played by Jessica Alba, dances to the delight of the crowd. We are also introduced to two characters that will factor in another story, Shelley, played by Brittany Murphy, and Dwight, played by Clive Owen. Hitmen show up to confront Marv, who beats the hell out of them. One of them tells Marv that someone named Telly Stern gave him the order. Just around the corner, someone who looks and smells like Goldie is following Marv. Not Goldie vows revenge on Marv for what he did to her in an attempt to make us believe Goldie is still alive. Marv dumps a man's head in a gross toilet, who tells Marv about a priest who is played by the man who is really responsible for all of this, Frank Miller. Marv confesses his sins and then lets on that one of the men he questioned led him here. The priest tells him Rourke is behind it, but this time it's the senator's brother, Cardinal Rourke. Marv's answers are at the family farm. Just before he goes there, Not Goldie tries to kill Marv with physics by hitting him at top speed in her car, and even tries to shoot him a bit before inexplicably driving off when he's clearly still alive. At the farm, he encounters a vicious dog that he punches unconscious until once again, the guy from Spy Kids 3 Game Over sneaks up on him and ends up hitting him in the head with a sledgehammer, which knocks him unconscious and is basically time travel in this movie. Marv awakens in a bathroom or basement or something to find Lucille in her normal naked state. We see the heads of other prostitutes on the wall, and Lucille tells us that Huck Finn made her watch him eat their bodies. He even gnawed off Lucille's hand and made her watch that too. While Marv looks for a way out, someone drives up to the farm and takes Frodo away. We finally know his name is Kevin. This gives Marv the chance to break out of their prison. A team of cops come to kill Marv, and Lucille hits him over the head with yet another knocking someone unconscious hit. The cops immediately dispose of Lucille like she's a completely unimportant character. Marv gets to work and destroys the cops. The cops give him the name of Cardinal Patrick Henry Rourke, played by Rutger Hauer. Apparently, he's the man of real power here. He made his brother a senator. Marv has a crisis near the Cardinal statue, thinking maybe he's hallucinated all of this. And this is something that I thought was a little half-baked. They talk about him hallucinating and he needs medicine and all of that, but I don't think it really factors too much into what happens that we see. So he needs to make sure what's happening is real. So he goes to Old Town, a part of Sin City that the women there run due to some arrangement with the police. And there, all the women there, I guess, are prostitutes. I don't want to make assumptions on everybody, but I believe they are. After asking some questions, Not Goldie shoots Marv in the shoulder. And the next thing we know, he's tied up, taking a beating while Gail, Rosario Dawson, and Becky, Alexis Bledel, watch. We find out Not Goldie is Wendy, Goldie's twin sister. Wendy thinks that Marv is the guy who abducted the other prostitutes, but Marv tells the truth, which they believe. After Wendy decides not to kill Marv, he shows that he could have gotten up and killed Wendy the whole time because Rosario Dawson doesn't know how to tie a Langford double. Wendy drives Marv out to the farm while he fills her in on the plot. She tells Marv that Goldie worked the clergy, which is a puzzle piece Marv can't understand right now. He goes and buys some supplies to kill Kevin, which we get to see through a Wes Anderson-style set of visuals. Despite all this planning, Kevin is really good at dodging all the traps for a while before Marv slaps some handcuffs on him. Wendy wants to help, but Marv punches her unconscious, of course, because he doesn't want her to see the grisly shit he's about to do to Kevin. He cuts off all of his limbs and feeds the rest of him, except his head, to the dog from earlier that he knocked unconscious. In perhaps the most famous scene from the movie, Kevin never once screams and apparently even enjoys it with a creepy smile on his face the whole time. Marv takes Wendy to Nancy's place because apparently he's friends with her. Then he drives off to confront the Cardinal at his compound. He shows up to Cardinal Rourke's bedroom with Kevin's head in his hand and places it on an open Bible. We find out that Kevin ate prostitutes because they filled him with white light. He didn't just eat their bodies, he ate their souls, and the Cardinal joined in. When Goldie approached Marv for protection, it was a great way of trying to frame the murders on someone else, although I am completely unclear why they needed to do so. As Marv kills the Cardinal, the cops come in and shoot him a million times, but he's saved by doctors. He recovers in a hospital, and then the cops try to beat a confession out of him. After they threaten his mom, he signs the confession, and he is put on death row for everyone who got killed in the story. Wendy visits him in prison, which may or may not be a hallucination. He goes to the chair, and it takes two electrocutions to kill him. Now we're on to the next story, where we see Shelley in her apartment being harassed by her boyfriend, Jackie Boy, played by Benicio del Toro, who's outside pleading to let him come in along with four of his buddies. She's obviously just slept with Dwight, but she's trying to keep that a secret. Dwight, yet another male savior in this movie, tells her to go ahead and open the door because he can handle them, but he eventually hides in the shower in the bathroom. Jackie Boy tells her he could break the door down if he wanted to, so she finally opens the door. After impressing his buddies with his misogyny, Jackie Boy goes to the bathroom. Shortly after that, Dwight is dunking his head in the movie's second toilet head dunking scene. After Dwight almost drowns him, he and his buddies leave. Dwight has a conversation with Shelley on a ledge outside, and she tells him that she has a complicated history with Jackie Boy. Dwight, who was convinced a minute ago that Jackie Boy would never bother her again, now tells her he needs to kill him because he's dangerous. He jumps off the ledge because nobody dies from gravity. Dwight chases after them, and a cop enters the picture shortly after. Jackie Boy goes to Old Town, where the cops have no authority. There, Jackie Boy tries to get Becky into the car with the prostitutes around town getting ready to defend her. When he pulls a gun, Miho, played by Devin Aoki, starts slicing everyone up, but not killing Jackie Boy. Kills everybody else. Miho throws an obstruction into Jackie Boy's gun, which Dwight warns him about, not to no avail, and Jackie Boy ends up getting a piece of gun stuck in his head. Miho turns his head into a Pez dispenser. When they run through his belongings, they find out he's a cop, which threatens the arrangement between the cops and Old Town, potentially allowing the mob and pimps to come back to the city and run things. So it's time to hide the evidence. Dwight asks for a car to port the dead body somewhere. Gail reminds Dwight that a cop was chasing them here before they arrived, so they'll know Jackie Boy was here before he died. So they'll search everywhere for him and know he was killed in Old Town. Dwight suggests dumping the bodies in the La Brea tar pits where the cops won't search. Oh, and fitting everyone in the crappy car will require Miho to cut up the bodies, except for the one recognizable face to the cops for some reason, Jackie Boy. Meanwhile, Becky is acting really suspicious and calls her mom, even though she's told not to use the phone during all of this. Dwight drives down the road where special guest director Quentin Tarantino does his one scene. Dwight hallucinates Jackie Boy talking to him, because if you're going to get Benicio del Toro, you might as well let him act. Dwight is pulled over for a broken taillight. He's able to convince the cop that there's no Weekend at Bernie's situation going on in the car, that the man in the passenger seat is drunk and he's the designated driver, and the cop lets him off with a warning. At the pits, an Irish gang tries to kill Dwight. Movie cuts back to Old Town, where the 2003 version of the Kingpin threatens Gail. He says he knows everything that has gone down and the mob is here to be the literal new sheriffs in town. Back at the pits, the Irish mercenaries search Dwight's belongings and find out too late that a policeman's badge stopped the bullet. Dwight kills them all, but a grenade sends Dwight into the tar pits. There, he notices two more Irish mercenaries cutting Jackie Boy's head off in the movie's second severed head moment. They need it for proof. Just as he's about to sink, Miho saves him out of a fucking nowhere. Dwight realizes that they have a spy in Old Town, and it's probably that chick that married Pete Campbell from Mad Men. They hop in a car and head off Brian, the guy who made off with Jackie Boy's head. A shootout occurs, and Dwight is forced to follow down a manhole cover, the movie's second trip to the sewers. Brian gets the drop on Dwight, but wastes so much time that Miho sneaks up behind him and kills him. The plan to save Gail and kill John Coffey from the Green Mile. Manute, that's Michael Clark Duncan's real character name, tortures Gail for a bit, and then Becky confesses she was the rat, to which Gail bites a slice of Becky's neck off for. Miho starts firing arrows across the street and hits Nicky Cat, who delivers probably the funniest moment of the movie when he gets hit and says, "Hey." It's basically a new twist on Message for You, Sir, because a message on the arrow proposes a deal. The cops head for Gail if you meet out back. This is a big trap, of course. It's an alley where all the women can be like Obi-Wan Kenobi and have the high ground. After the exchange, we find out there's a bomb planted on Jackie Boy's head that serves as a diversion and a setup to killing every last gangster in the alley as they all get blown away by the women above. After that, we're taken back to Hartigan, who did not die in the previous story. He's visited by Senator Rourke, who tells him that Rourke Jr. is in a coma. But as much as he wants to kill Hartigan, he wants him alive to take the fall for all the crimes that his son actually did. So, much like Marv, he's being asked to sign a confession to cover for the Rourke family. Rourke is even paying for Hartigan's heart surgery. If Hartigan tells the truth to anyone, they're dead. 11-year-old Nancy visits him and tells him she knows that they're lying about him. She promises to write him letters with the name of Cordelia, revealing nothing about her identity. He spends 8 years in Hannibal Lecter's cell getting letters from Nancy. Finally, the letters stop. She reasons that she's grown out of it now that she's 19. He gets a visit from Rourke Jr., now known as the Yellow Bastard, and Hartigan gets the 1 millionth punch that causes unconsciousness in this movie. When he wakes up, he sees a letter in his cell with a finger that he believes is Nancy's. He now must confess, which gets him out of prison. Michael Madsen drives him to Nancy's apartment while Yellow Bastard follows. Nancy's apartment looks ransacked. He finds a matchbook that leads him to Katie's saloon, where Nancy does her dancing gig. He doesn't recognize the 19-year-old Nancy at first, but when he realizes she's okay, he realizes that the bad guys probably wanted him to lead them to her, and that it's best that she doesn't recognize him. But she does recognize him, runs off the stage, and plants a big kiss on him. Nancy drives a car, apparently only she can drive, to a motel. Yellow Bastard shows up to try to kill them. Hartigan shoots him in the head, and his car careens off the cliff. They go to confirm the kill, but he isn't there because he took advantage of that to jump into the backseat of Nancy's car. At the motel, Nancy tries to put the moves on Hartigan, but he resists due to their age difference until he realizes that Nancy is Jessica Alba. Still, he keeps his cool by taking a cold shower, where Yellow Bastard attacks him. This is where he reveals that he is Rourke Jr. Yellow Bastard sedates Nancy and has Hartigan hanging precariously by a noose and held up by a table. When the table is kicked away, Hartigan does some real John McClane shit and gets out of the situation. He finishes off the wordy goons sent to dispose of his body, and one of them tells him about the notorious farm. On the run through the farm, he realizes his heart condition is back and he's going to die. After killing a couple of guys outside, he runs to save Nancy but gets shot before reenacting a scene from Die Hard where the bad guys give him some good advice. Finally, he enters the house to save Nancy, and in a mirroring of the first story, this time he can't lift his gun to kill Rourke, but he can use a knife, and he does the same thing he did to Rourke earlier by disarming both his weapons. He tells Nancy he's going to gather evidence for the cops, lying to her so that she'll leave. He then takes his own life, figuring there's no way he can serve justice without putting Nancy in danger again. At the end of this movie, Becky is at a hospital getting treatment for her gunshot wound, and she runs into Josh Hartnett, who does the spiel from the first scene of the movie. He's obviously there to do what he did to the customer, and what I guess is also Becky contracting her own murder. Aaron, what did you think of Sin City?
The first time I watched Sin City, I did not much like it. I think I gave it like 2.5 stars. And this is not typically the kind of movie that would appeal to me. And after watching it again, it is still not quite the movie that would appeal to me. I think watching any movie with, closer inspection is a really interesting process. And I'm glad that I did. And I'm really enjoying, episode one of this new series, because there is something about taking a closer look with the benefit of the doubt to something that you may have dismissed. And this is a movie that I had dismissed. And I will tell you there were some things I found to enjoy about this. Mm-hmm. Number one, visually, this movie is really, really stunning. I think that's clear from the beginning to the end. There's this moment, very early on where the character's eyes are mentioned and they flash green. And just those kind of little touches, I think, are fun throughout the movie, although that one's a little undercut because everybody's eyes flash colors at one point, and I was trying to figure out if that was some sort of meaning there or metaphor there, but I couldn't place my finger on it if there were. The way it's designed, like the graphic novel with the black and white silhouettes and all of those kind of things, I found really interesting. The lengths they went to translate the blood is like this white fluorescent, kind of liquid, is really, really visually interesting. Love that stuff. I think the prosthetics in this movie are amazing.
Yeah.
I think they did something to Benicio del Toro and I can't figure it out, but it's prosthetics.
It's a nose and a chin prosthetic.
Okay. And it's still Benicio, but it's like, but no, that's not Benicio. And it's just so subtle and so interesting. I really love what they did with all these characters with prosthetics. Mm-hmm. Some of the noir dialogue is good. Not all of it, but there are some moments where I really found myself enjoying the turn of the phrase. Early on, I'll just give you an example. Early on, the silencer makes a whisper of the gunshot is a interesting way to say that. I'll hold her close until she's gone. I'll never know what she was running from. I'll cash her check in the morning. That's just a really interesting sentence to sentence turn, that I really, really liked. If I'm overly generous. There are some there are possibly some metaphorical things going on here that I noticed this time. For instance, in the fight with Frodo, with Psycho Frodo, as you said, there is something about the idea of the only way to defeat evil is to handcuff yourself to it. And I think that's an overarching theme of this movie, is the idea of out-eviling the evil for good purposes, you know, kind of thing. And possibly an overarching theme of the Sin City graphic novel as well. And then there's stuff with religion here that's interesting, how religion is, how it turns the, you know, you mentioned eating the white light, you know, of people, and the idea that it turns from empowering people to, you know, find that light in their life, that joy, their souls, you know, to nurturing their souls, to abusing their souls, to feeding on their souls, and how power can do that. And the corruption that's involved there, I thought that was at least an interesting concept and an interesting thought. Some of the negatives that I noticed a little more this time, I think the interconnected stuff just feels really light and passing. I wish it was a little more substantial. Like, we just see characters from some of the other, you know, stories. Really, there are three basic stories here, right? Like, I'm not, I mean, if you count the bookends, maybe there are four, but But yeah, we're really dealing with those three main stories. And I kind of wish the stories impacted each other a little bit more, maybe, or something, so that this felt like a cohesive, full piece of storytelling or art, as opposed to some thematically connected vignettes. And there's nothing wrong with a vignette movie. I can dig a vignette movie. But in this case, it just it felt like there wasn't a lot connecting what was going on here, especially because it was winked at least. Like, we saw these characters in the same world. If it's going to be completely, you know, an anthology, then that's fine too. But this just kind of wanted its cake and eat it too in some ways, I think. And that made me wonder what will be my final thought with Sin City, which is, I wonder if this in the modern day would have been a better, like, anthology series, like on Netflix or Max or something, where each episode is a different story from the Frank Miller universe. And sometimes, you know, kind of like a Black Mirror thing. Like, Black Mirror doesn't, you know, it isn't interconnected, but it is if you've watched it, you know, like it occasionally is. I just wonder what the Black Mirror version of Sin City looks like, and if that might have been a better way to dig into this material. But overall, the philosophy and the worldview of this material just doesn't sync up with mine in a lot of ways. So I find myself becoming a little disinterested and you know, distracted. But yeah, I was able to find a few things this time through. What about you?
Yeah, I can't come out and say that I ended up liking this movie. I may like it more than I did. There were things about it to, you know, we start with the visuals because that's the thing. He's shot all of this pretty much on green screen. And it looks great, how they ended up doing it. It doesn't look like a movie it occasionally can look like a green screen movie, but what I was hooked on really more on this time was the performances that stood out. Obviously, Mickey Rourke, this was during a time where he was having a resurgence. And, you know, he was in The Wrestler, and he ended up in Iron Man 2, of course, later on, but he was having a career resurgence at this point. This guy used to be the big IT actor in the 80s, and then a lot of things happened in his personal life that got him derailed from that. In fact, Mickey Rourke looked like Bruce Willis back in the day. It's kind of interesting that both of these guys are in this movie. But of course, Mickey Rourke is in this. I think my favorite actor in this is Clive Owen. I think he really sinks his teeth into everything in this. That scene where he's kissing Rosario Dawson, and then he interrupts it to turn around and say, "Get me a hard top with a big trunk," you know, and all that. I love that. Yeah. I love that part of it. I think Bruce Willis is serviceable. I've always enjoyed Bruce Willis. I don't know if I've ever been like, wow, he was just amazing in this. He does his serviceable stuff in this.
Right.
I thought Jessica Alba was bad in this movie. I was rooting for her on this, but there were moments I thought she was adding things to her performance, like little, like almost nervous kind of tics to the things she was saying. I didn't like it. Alexis Bledel does not belong in the, she does not pull off that hooker mm-hmm. character at all, especially when she starts talking with that. She's talking to Rosario Dawson towards the end, and she keeps on I ain't never going to be, you know, she keeps putting these mm-hmm. negatives in her sentences and everything. Right. She doesn't pull it off very well at all. The big thing that and Brittany Murphy is great in this movie.
I thought Brittany Murphy was one of the best things in the movie. I thought she was insanely good.
Oh, everything, every line reading is like a welcome breath of fresh air.
Yes.
It's so
yes.
good. The thing that I kept coming back to, now I really did. I gave this movie a lot of watches over the weekend because mm-hmm. I watched it like I normally do. I watched commentaries. I even watched some of the extended stuff that like they cut out. Like you didn't may not have noticed, but Carla Gugino is Bruce Willis's lawyer in the scene where he's confessing and everything. Mm-hmm. There's a whole mm-hmm. scene where she talks to him, but I was watching a lot of that. And so I watched quite a bit of this. And the thing that just kept on creeping up for me is that this movie is too repetitive for all the creativity that mm-hmm. is in it, with all the, you know, the Elijah Wood character is amazing. I think he's in it just enough, like too much of him would have ruined his character. But when you see characters like him and you see like Yellow Bastard and all these like really creative things, it really is kind of disappointing when it becomes a big slugfest and a shootout and all these things. And like I said, how many times during the synopsis do I say, well, he gets knocked unconscious and
right.
then it happens more than 10 times. I say a million, but it happens more than 10 times, I believe, in this mm-hmm. movie. That was what kept coming up for me, is that everything's repetitive. The Marv and Hartigan stories are so closely, they're so close together. The exact same things happen in that they're almost disposable. One of the other is disposable because it's the same story. It's, oh, I'm going to save these women or I'm going to save this girl. But as you kind of alluded to, one of the things that I do like about this movie is the sort of the theme of almost kind of like no good deed goes unpunished
right.
kind of stuff type
right.
of things, where they go off and they feel like they can do this and keep their hands clean, but they know they're not. The whole point of the whole point of this is basically self-sacrifice in the end. It's always what they end up doing in these things. But it's so that was what was disappointing, the repetitiveness of not only those two stories, which are back to back essentially, but just all the action in it is in there. I could have done a lot more with Old Town in this, really, honestly, and just had some more stories that centered around that rather than, you know, two men trying to save every woman they run across. Even the in the Marv story, he goes to Nancy's house and you know, oh, the reason why they're friends is because he took out a frat boy that was that smacked her around one time or whatever. So it's like the whole movie is this. It's men saving women from their thing. And even the Old Town stuff where the women are they're supposed to have the power. They seem to, aside from Miho, it feels like everybody else is kind of waiting for Clive Owen to do something in this to me. So anyway, in the end, I would not recommend this movie, but I was glad to give it another shot. It was fun listening to the commentaries, Rodriguez and Quentin Tarantino talking about this. I even listened to a little bit of the Rodriguez and Frank Miller one. I have no doubt that the movie that they set out to make is exactly what's on screen. So if you're going to go by, is this a success or failure based on what they attempted? It's a perfect movie for what they attempted. They did exactly what they wanted to do. I mean, it's practically a shot. It's almost a shot for shot remake of Frank Miller's own source material.
Right.
I was very surprised to hear that Frank Miller was as much of a director as he was on set for this too. Thought that was very interesting, but
yeah,
in the end, yeah, this is not a movie for me. I think that Rodriguez exudes more style than substance for me. And that's what I've gotten from most of those. And in the poster behind me from Dusk Till Dawn is probably my favorite movie of his. Just cause it's just all fun all the time. And it's just, you know, it's as mindless, but it doesn't ever seem like super repetitive and things like of that nature, like this one is. But yeah. Anyway, let's go to our super secret double feature for this movie.
Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
Sure. You know, I've been thinking about what I chose, and it may be a bit on the nose, but it felt right for me for this movie. I'm going with Watchmen for a double feature with this. I recently revisited Watchmen as well, another movie that I just didn't care much for the first time I watched it. I actually did like Watchmen more the second time I watched it.
Yeah, same here.
I actually think it's doing some interesting things. It is also very noir. It's also based on a graphic novel. You know, it's also a very visual director doing, you know, a lot of visual things to highlight the material. I was really glad I went back and rewatched it and gave it another chance, because I actually think that there's some substance here that I missed the first time around. So, yeah, Watchmen, another rated R adaptation of an adult graphic novel. So, yeah.
I am down with that. Okay. So, what is next week's homework, Aaron?
I am going to continue this theme at least for 1 week. We'll see how it goes. if we both keep hating these, then maybe I'll need to throw in a good movie. This is widely considered to be a good movie, though. So I am in the vast minority on this. Has a 7.6 on IMDb, 80% on Rotten Tomatoes, 78% Metacritic. This is 1998's Malick film, The Thin Red Line. I, first time I watched this, was bored out of my skull. I did not enjoy this movie and have since had many, many people tell me, go back and watch it with your new, you know, your evolved cinema mind since 1998, which granted was 26 years ago. So, so I'm excited to revisit it, see if it is actually a much better movie than I experienced the first time I watched it. So next week will be The Thin Red Line.
And yes, this does have Sean Penn, along with a million other big name actors who are all, most of them are playing small roles. Like you'll see Clooney show up and you see John Travolta show up. And I think the people who stay around longest are people like Adrian Brody shows up in there for a bit. And you have Elias Koteas and Nick Nolte and all those guys. Those guys are there for a long time. But this was an interesting year, because in 1998, you had the three World War II era movies get nominated for Oscars: Saving Private Ryan, Thin Red Line, and Life is Beautiful. And then you had the two Elizabethan era movies that were went right after that: Shakespeare in Love, which won Best Picture, and then you had just Elizabeth, was the five nominees for Best Picture that year. So,
and part of my distaste for this movie may be how much I love Saving Private Ryan, in the inevitable human thing where we compare two similar things, and this movie is not Saving Private Ryan. They are doing very different things and presented in very different ways. Malick and Spielberg are very different filmmakers. So,
yep, it is exactly the kind of war movie you would expect the guy that Days of Heaven would make.
Yes,
so,
yes, exactly.
Let's go with one question, I guess.
Question.
I got something to say.
I want the truth.
I'm listening.
On here, let me look through our goodie bag. Since I've been skipping the food ones, let's do a food one. What is your favorite non-burger sandwich?
A nice simple food question. All right, I'm going with a grilled peanut butter, banana, and honey sandwich. This is one of my own creations. Peanut butter and honey is a great sandwich to begin with. Peanut butter and banana, also a great sandwich to begin with. And I just thought, what about all three? And then I thought, what if we slather some butter on that puppy, put it on a grill, and heat it up?
And always makes it better, in my opinion.
I agree, and it is a delicious treat. So yeah, I would go with grilled peanut butter, banana, and honey. There is a Tropical Smoothie Cafe has a wrap with peanut butter, granola, and honey and banana, and I'm like, you kind of stole my thing, and
sure did.
And it's delicious as well. So now you can have somebody else make you one. You don't even have to make your own.
There's a particular sandwich that I always get at Jersey Mike's. It's the original Italian. And it's got all the meats on it. It's got lettuce. And, you know, they have Mike's Way, which I don't get everything Mike's Way. I take the onions off. I'm not a big onions person. But then I'll add peppers and I'll add oil and vinegar and all sorts of good stuff to that sandwich. So that's my go-to. That's like, if I'm like, man, I'm really thinking of a sandwich, I DoorDash that over to my front door as quickly as possible. That's my thing. Yep. Looking at the chat, we have Polly says a taco. Let's start that debate. Die the Hero says a Cuban. I like Cubans. I don't have nearly enough Cubans in my life. I think it's a good sandwich. Flyboy says Reuben. Reubens are great for sure.
It's the only wholly invented sandwich.
Yes. Nick Jagged says grilled peanut butter, fluff, and banana. Never had that. I couldn't tell you. Link says club sandwich. Castro says spicy chicken from Wendy's. I like that a lot. Josh Zero says egg fried in butter, mayo on toasted bread, slice of whatever cheese you like. I call it the heart attack sandwich. You're probably right, Josh, and it sounds delicious. I want one right now. Nick says bacon, egg, and cheese on a bagel or sourdough bread is my favorite. Yes, bacon, egg, and good. Cheese. Can't go wrong with that. Slab says had an epic brisket melt, not grilled cheese. It's a melt the other day, or just two cheese, grilled cheese, peanut butter, honey, and banana sandwich is epic. Polly says French toast bread, fried egg, sausage, and cheese. Whoa, now that sounds intriguing. So, yeah, there you go. Lots of good answers in the chat as well. All right, so we're going to continue this. Movies we don't like that we're going to big recommend on our recommend show. I love it. Next week will be The Thin Red Line from 1998. Thank you again, chat, for coming out and watching us talk about movies. But that's going to do it for today. We'll see ya.
See you guys.
Bye. Part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com. I think we're at a point now where, you know, I think you'll be able to cut out my worst and keep my best. So,
yeah. And fight for it to come back is simply you just going, I want that back of me, and going, okay, there's no fighting involved.
Right. There's hardly ever any, but no. I mean, I guess there's times where people want to fight for something that you're like, but I know that this is not a thing.
Right.
Or I know that this is, you know, like the whole thing becomes, now do I go through the whole evidentiary process as to why this is not a sin?
Right. Yeah. You know,
yeah. So it does, but it is kind of a thing. If somebody really wants something and the other person's like, well, I got that for a reason.
It's an interesting process. I think I can only speak for myself personally. I know when I started off, I was much more aware of what of my stuff was getting cut, which I think serves a good purpose too. It's an educational purpose, right? Of like, okay, here's kind of what the experts think, you know, work, doesn't work, that kind of stuff. But I was much more likely to go back through and go, hey, what about these three, you know? And part of that was, I kind of like these. And another part of that was, help me understand what I missed here so I don't do it again, right? So like like, you know, learning process you're going through. And then as time goes on, like, if somebody wants to cut one of my sins, I'm just like, yeah, just leave it on the floor. It's okay. Like, there's plenty here that'll, you know, unless I feel like it's, you know, unless I feel like something was missed, like maybe they missed this clever thing that I was doing, then I might bring it back up. But, you know, other than that.
Yeah, there's very rarely something that you're like, this video cannot live without this thing.
I've been overall very, very impressed with, you know, we have a pretty small team, but just the ability, like, creative collaboration is difficult, like, because everybody has a different opinion on, like, what works, what doesn't, what's funny, what's interesting. Like, you know, we all are different people with different perspectives, which is part of what makes it work. But, like, you know, you hear of creative partnerships, especially just like breaking apart after so many years, because it's just so hard to continue to do that. And I've been really impressed with everybody's ability just to be like, we're here for a common goal. We're trying to put something fun together and, you know, no hard feelings. Nobody seems to take it personally, which is really, really nice.
Yeah. And it shouldn't be taken that way. You know, I think, those creative processes were processes where people are, you know, the band breaks up or whatever. It's
right.
To me, it's always someone in that group has more power than the other, and everything that they come up with is the way it should be, and everything that you do, we're going to marginalize it in some way. And then those people who are getting marginalized have to think, well, is this something that I can live with or not? And that's where it comes down to. I'm sure there are plenty of bands where it's like, yep, that guy's the leader, and I'm just going to go with whatever they say and whatever. But some of them are like, man, I've got some really good ideas. This would have been a really good, you think I always, any form of entertainment, where it's movies, music, anything, you hear the stories of how they're made and you just go, this was a miracle this got made.
Yeah.
Because it took these set of circumstances for people to realize that this was good in the first place. Or things that they didn't think was good, they put out there and became huge hits or whatever. And then they had to realize, even the people who created them had to realize after the fact what was brilliant about some of those things. That's why it's hard to be like, well, this thing that I wrote is the best thing ever or whatever. But this often happens when I'm going all over the place. This often happens when you've combined a script and there are alts, and it seems like your partner is picking every single one that they wrote. I don't like getting mine picked all the time, 100% either. I think there's something kind of like, well, are you just kind of deferring to me just saying, but just occasionally it's like, I like this one that I wrote. I like this one that I wrote. And a lot of times I'll sit there and I'll be like, God, it seems like they're picking the one that they wrote all the time. And then you'll read it and you go, yeah, they're right.
Yeah, I had the same thing. Yeah. I've also, as a combiner, a while back started to understand the alting process isn't just about if we wrote something that's the same, making it an alt, because if I'm combining and I like mine better enough that I'm going to fight for it, if they pick their own, then just pick mine. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, you know,
that's
like
the way I go about
pick
it.
The better one. If there's an obvious better one, you don't need to, you know, alt it. Now I say obvious again, it's creative work. There's nothing is obvious, but like if there's one that just seems, you know, funnier, I'll just pick that one and really save the alts for like, I wasn't sure which way to go on this. And that way, whatever they pick, I'm like totally good with, because, you know, I genuinely wasn't sure. It wasn't like I had an opinion, you know, when I put the alts on there. So yeah, that was something I learned, you know, a little while back that's been really helpful, because I'd find myself alting everything and then I'd get to the script process and they'd pick the one I didn't think was as good. And I'd be like, oh, well, now I have to say I kind of want this one.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And then why did you alt it in the first place? You know?
Yeah, it feels like it's self-evident. And for the most part, when you do write those, people do pick the one that is clearly the best.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
But yeah, I do the same thing. It's I look at it and I'm going, well, and it goes both ways. If I wrote it and it's better, I'm going to pick it. If they wrote it and it's better, I'm going to pick it and not alt it. But like, yeah, other ones, it's kind of like you're just kind of saying the same thing with different wording.
Right.
Sometimes they're both super good and then they end up being combined into one thing.
Yeah, it's an interesting creative process. But I think everybody handles it, you know, really, really well. It's very rare to have any kind of, you know, too much back and forth in that,
yeah.
You know, to have somebody in poker parlance, you know, four bet something is very rare.
The days of just Jeremy and I going back and forth on these things, man, such a distant memory at this point. But man, we did things so much differently. I mean, like the script combining process was fairly much the same. I mean nothing has much changed from that, except for what formats we were using. And you go back and look at the old stuff that I was writing is on Notepad. And then it went to Microsoft Word, and then we figured out the key to the Google Sheets. But like the videos themselves, like we try to get videos done well in advance these days, but there were nights where it was like 4 o'clock in the morning, the day of the video launch, we're sitting there going, I don't know if we want to keep this in the video, or I don't want, you know, just like haggling over stuff like that. I think we've talked about this before. I'm not sure. I wouldn't mind. I don't think I mind it being in the outtake.
Okay.
There was a line that Jeremy wrote, I believe it was in The Conjuring. There's a part where Patrick Wilson says, "This was the best Latin I've ever heard," or something like that, talking about somebody that the couple is in that movie.
Mm-hmm.
Can't remember their name right now. They were doing a job where this guy is speaking the best Latin I've ever heard, and we have a sin about it. And I was going back to Jeremy, and I was like, don't you think that his comment there is, I think the sin was something like, you don't know what the perfect Latin is because no one's ever really spoken the language in front of you and all this stuff. And I was like, don't you think that maybe it's just the fact that the guy pronounces the words correctly and it sounds good and all, that's what he's getting at. It's not really so much about the technical aspect of it. And he fought for it. And I was like, okay. And that was something that I was like asking to cut in the video. It had made it to video stage. And then we went back and forth, and there was a point where, because we were doing the editing at the time, I convinced him to cut it, and then because email is the way it is, he said, I like this, I want to keep it. And I said, man, I don't know about this and whatever. And I sat there for a second. I'm like, okay, we're just going to keep this in the video, whatever. If people hate it, they hate it, whatever. And then I came back and I said, yeah, you know what? Just go ahead and keep it. And he's like, oh, I've already cut it. And I was like, but you convinced me. You convinced me that it should stay. And so then he put it back in. And then, of course, one of the first comments when we launched that video was about that sin. And it's just, you know, it's like, it's just, oh man, those days were really fun though. Well, and I was sitting there going, well, we were trying to adhere to a schedule, and I understand that. Adhere to a schedule, not only the day, but the time. And I was sitting there going, what does it matter if we just come out with it a few hours later or something like that, or the next day, even sometimes, who cares? And but we were I think we just held firm that it should be Tuesdays, and it was back then it was just Tuesdays, and then we end up Tuesdays and Thursdays with two videos. But you know, it was I was just sitting there like, we can change anything we want and just make it perfect, and who cares if we hold off on it and everything. Now it's gotten to the point where it's like, yeah, Jeremy was right. Let's just keep it the way it is. If people don't like a certain thing, they're not going to like a lot of certain things that we didn't even argue about. So
yeah, that is the thing you start to learn is, like, it doesn't matter what you do, somebody is going to argue. Like, we're very careful. We genuinely in our script process are like, we use the word argumentative a lot. Like, if something can be argued too much both ways, you know, what are we even doing here? Unless the joke is really, really good, you know, let's figure out a different way to say this or do something else. It doesn't matter. Everything is argumentative to the internet. The internet can argue with anything.
That's absolutely true.
It does not matter.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place. That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.